This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Brian Fernandez. It's Thursday, the 22nd of March, 2018. And the morning run takes you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or tweeting us at BFM Radio. Brian, what do we have in terms of news that people really should remember when they go to work today or they're around the water cooler?
Well, I think the big story today is the story of Cambridge Analytica, and it continues to generate waves across the world.
Yeah, Cambridge Analytica. Interesting because of, we had the major admission of a mistake by Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg there, saying that the trust was at the heart of what went wrong. And I think depending on who you are, you might either consider this a genuine apology or not. Also in the UK, Theresa May, the Prime Minister, has been challenged to explain her party's links with Cambridge Analytica, as well as in India. What do we have on India, Brian?
Well, basically, India has taken down the local websites of Cambridge Analytica. And amazingly, I didn't realize it until I Googled it. There's something like 300 permanent employees, and they have about 1,400 contractors and consultants.
In India alone. Right. And parties on both sides of the divide, the major parties, BJP, as well as Congress, both accusing each other of using the services of Cambridge Analytica and suggesting that this is not acceptable. Also, we have, interestingly in the mix, the question of resignations. We have the resignation of the president of Myanmar. If you remember the individual who became the president of Myanmar, Brian, when Aung San Suu Kyi won a place in parliament? Do you remember who he was?
No, I don't. No,
it's very interesting because he was the man who drove her car. Right.
All I know is that he was her right hand person for many, many years.
Yes, he was. But he also was in a practical sense her personal driver. Because a man of his stature himself, but he did in fact drive the car, and it was a move essentially to seal her position. So while he was president of the Union of Myanmar, it was she who apparently was holding all the power, because we know that the military there holds many of the cards. Also, we have the story of James Packer, that Australian billionaire, I think the eighth richest man in Australia. Now, he was set some years ago to marry an American celebrity.
Yes, he was supposed to marry Mariah Carey. But unfortunately, I think they had a falling out, and he's just resigned, citing mental health issues.
He has. What's interesting about that falling out, I believe he had to pay her for that breakup. He paid her for perhaps promises that he could not fulfill. Now, we're going to be back with a look at the question of mental health. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm sure I could. And with me, Brian Fernandez. That was the Smiths with their 1984 hit, Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now. I'm not miserable, but if you are, and if it's chronic, you might actually have a mental health issue. Now, I think there's a lot of stigma around the word mental. In fact, I think in colloquial terms, we can always say, oh, that guy's mental. And that's, and that's one way of stigmatizing, right? It's partly humorous, but it's also a way of suggesting that you're not altogether there. You're not. I mean, there are all kinds of expressions in the English language that help you, that nails the issue. Now, we picked up on this story yesterday, because the health ministry conducted a study which found that over 18,000 Malaysians suffer from various stages of depression. So specific to mental health, there are all kinds of mental health issues. Depression is just one of them, right? You could have schizophrenia, you could have bipolar syndrome and such. But the important thing is that at this point in time, there isn't enough recognition of the problem. Now, we spoke to international psychologist Dr. Angela Singh Bias, who's shared her thoughts on whether there can be some improvement to the situation of depression.
Well, there is definitely improvement. We have a long way to go. And we have the media also to thank for that, have been great partners in raising awareness and education. There still is a stigma to receive, mental health help, which is very mystifying for psychiatrists and psychologists alike, because people have no problem on average getting aggressive or multiple treatments, for example, let's say for cancer or, going to a cardiologist if there's a heart problem. But, with depression, quite often the refrain is it's just in your mind or it's a character weakness. Just get over it. And if it were that easy, people would. And I would also question, it's been identified in some studies, for example, there's 18 psychologists available for every 30,000 Malaysians. So even for all the research that's being done, we have to ask how many people are not receiving help because they're not aware of what's happening. They can't identify it. There's too much shame. They feel like they have too much to lose. Maybe workplaces are not equipped to handle that in a fair way. So there's a lot of moving parts, and it needs to be a joint effort.
That was psychologist Anjala Singh Bias speaking about the things that maybe that need to happen, including the infrastructure, but also just the recognition by individuals that a mental health issue is something worth investing in, and it is the treatment of it.
And also, Sharad, one of the things that struck me is how difficult the situation is in terms of lack of qualified personnel. So if you have only 18 psychologists for every 30,000 Malaysia, even if Malaysians want to seek help, there's just not enough psychologists or psychiatrists to just go around.
Yeah, in fact, yesterday we had a WhatsApp message come in about somebody sharing the situation that their sibling was in, experiencing where, the sibling would go to a public hospital and the doctor would always be a different person. So his or her brother often had to repeat their situation. So there wasn't continuity, there wasn't a depth of understanding of the issue, and there were long queues. So when you consider that the private healthcare options might be quite expensive, I mean, some places charging up to 500 ringgit an hour for, say, a therapeutic session.
And right? How many people can afford that? Because even at 500 ringgit an hour, even middle class Malaysian, I mean, it's way out of reach for.
Yeah, so that's just Malaysian. I understand one of the high end of the spectrum. But there's the other issue of whether, say, our insurance system covers questions of mental health, right? So the cost issue might be covered in some respects if, in fact, the insurance system acknowledges this as a condition that can be covered.
In fact, one of the ways perhaps that once there's greater awareness of this issue, the easiest first steps then would be perhaps for employers to then cover their employees or take some sort of insurance against that. That would be an easier fix because I think awareness is now the big issue.
Yeah, I'm
as
wondering,
well.
Although, whether in fact employers, how enlightened the majority of employers in this country are with regard to mental health, would they, if they're confronted with the fact that one of their employees might have a mental health issue, would they be more likely to try and ease them out of that job as opposed to try and help them get the right treatment?
So I would think that, and this is, of course, generalizing, if you're a large multinational company, you're based out of Europe or US, some of your HR practices are obviously, or most of your HR practices are probably replicated in Malaysia as well. So they, I would assume, would be a little bit more open and progressive in this area. Perhaps then some of the GLCs could take the lead in among the local companies to give these sort of benefits to employees and also in the HR departments really have a more concrete understanding of how they can help their employees.
Okay, we'll be back with a look at the Malaysian flag from an American eye. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Supertramp with Breakfast in America. Supertramp's a British rock band formed in the late 60s. I'm Sharad Kutin, and I was born in the late 60s. I was born in the middle of the 60s. With me, Brian Fernandez.
Who was born in the 70s.
Yeah, just in the 70s. Don't make it sound like you're so much younger. You're not. Okay. We'll look at an interesting story that came on the news just yesterday Malaysian engineer Munir Zainal, he hosted a party to celebrate Hari Raya last year at a property owned by an American Employees Association. What he didn't know was that he would soon be investigated on suspicion of being a terrorist. Now, following the party, the association reported Munir to his employers on suspicion that he had infiltrated or been affiliated to a radical Islamic terrorist, alleging that he used the venue to hold an ISIS meeting.
Now, on what grounds? Apparently, the Americans thought that the Malaysian flag was an American flag that was desecrated with ISIS symbols, and observed that Munir's guests were apparently dressed in Muslim clothing. So this led to an FBI investigation on Munir, and now Munir is suing the Employees Association for racial profiling and religious discrimination.
Yeah, that's fairly interesting, because through American eyes, the Malaysian flag seems very familiar. And of course it is, because that's in fact part of our history. And I believe there were competing flags presented to the Malayan public when the flag was first, was mooted that they needed a flag for the new nation. And so it was perfectly reasonable for that American person to see the American flag there, because that in fact was the model. The problem was not knowing the history of various countries, and maybe it would be unreasonable to expect, or was it, to expect people to know this history.
But the question here, I think, Sharad, is more about racial profiling. Why, and the fact that, unfortunately, Muslims around the world are now stigmatized.
Yeah, that may be true, right? So, but this story comes with that added misrecognition issue. And I think that's quite interesting, partly because I wonder how many of us even know that history ourselves, including all the various ways in which America, symbolized the future for many soon-to-be independent decolonizing nations. I mean, Malaysia on one hand, Vietnam, all these countries, right?
And, if you look at the similarity of flags, if you look at Liberia's, for example, Liberia's is very similar to Malaysia. So it's the
And very similar then, therefore, to the American flag.
So
the American flag is a template, right, in many ways for many countries coming out of that particular period. But we also know that American Revolution, the revolution that led to the independence of the American colony, had profound influence around the world, including the French Revolution. And, or if you look at Ho Chi Minh's statements about what they aspired to when he was fighting for independence. Vietnam, independent of French colonial rule. It was America that he looked to. I mean, do we know this history? I mean, how much do we value history, actually, in our daily lives?
I think not enough. Most of us don't know our history well enough, even though we may have studied it like 30. In my case, I actually did history up to A-levels, but I've forgotten most of it. But one thing I
and
do
you don't
remember,
read histories. You don't read history books now, or watch documentaries on history or whatever.
Not as much. Particularly since I stopped. Unfortunately, when I stopped watching TV, I think I used to watch a history
but
channel.
But what feeds
a lot.
Your brain then, Brian? I mean, if it's not television, one of the things that we also it's a little factoid about the Tugu Peringatan. The statue that commemorates the emergency. Well, it started off as a statue to commemorate the emergency. It's been extended to other things. But the man behind that statue is an Austrian-American who did that very famous statue of Iwo Jima, if you remember. How many Malaysians know that?
No, I think very few Malaysians would know that.
Yeah, but it's an important part of our history. I mean, for us, some of us who have antipathy, as it were, towards America, I think America's an imperialist nation, or we don't like it for all kinds of reasons, and under the Trump dispensation, it's even less attractive. To remember, there was a time that America did lead, or at least was, a major model for many who struggled to think about how they wanted to shape their new nations.
Yeah, and remember, if you go back further in history, the American struggle came out of British imperialism.
Absolutely, in the new colonies, in the new world. Okay, taking us up to the first bulletin in the morning, we have Sugar Ray with Someday. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez, and that was My Generation by The Who. You can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 and tweeting us at BFM Radio. And CJ has WhatsApped us. Thank you very much, CJ, for your tweet. You were weighing in on the mental health issue and you say, I work in an MNC. Our colleagues in Europe get to take stress leave. I've not heard of a similar policy at our Malaysia office, and it was certainly not covered in our onboarding briefing. So in many ways, Brian, you know, CJ's WhatsApp addresses the presumption that you made earlier that with MNCs, these standards will be globalized and that they could take the lead. But if this is anecdote is any example of what's going on, you know, the benefits in Europe the world don't necessarily translate to local benefits.
Yeah, I suppose it's also then the local management. It could be buried somewhere in a fine print in the employee handbook, but they choose not to highlight it.
And that's interesting in itself, right? And maybe in many ways, you know, feeding into a local perspective on issues of stress and mental health. And CJ goes on to say, Asian thinking is usually deal with it, or if you can't perform, please leave. So kind of much more harsh and less generous in our attitudes towards people who are under stress, and our employees are under stress. Now we turn to the question of political parties driven by a kind of youthful energy, not just youthful energy. People say some older people have, in fact, quite a bit of drive and energy, but youth politics. And Indonesia is no exception in this, and recently has established a millennial-based party, Indonesian Solidarity Party, or Party Solidarity Indonesia, I guess, with PSI would be the acronym, is apparently a kind of a game changer there in the Republic.
Yeah, so basically, they're an upstart on the political stage. They hope to tap into young voters' contempt for the corruption. Now, they are obviously tapping into the demographics in Indonesia as well, because essentially 30% of their electorate basically are between the ages of 17 and 35.
Now, you know, that's so that's a demographic issue, but, you know, Indonesia is an archipelago of, you know, well, I don't know, 30,000, 37,000 islands, and the regional differences are extraordinary. So, you know, I wonder how this party will be able to move on. I'm presuming it's starting in Jakarta. How will it be able to make sense of all the variety of forces and dynamics there are in Indonesian society today? But it's an interesting story, because we look to Malaysia as well. When we look to Malaysian politics, we ask ourselves often, you know, what kind of game changers are in the offing for Malaysian politics? The real game changer has been, if you believe analysts, a man who's 93. So, you know, so that's, you know, our game changer came from somebody who was part of the establishment, part of an elite.
But our game changer left the
Well, he never really left, did he?
Well, that's true.
Okay, so the question is, but you see, interestingly enough, and we've had on the Breakfast Grill, Syed Saddiq, who's one of the fresher faces in Bersatu, the party that Tun Dr. Mahathir leads, and in fact, perhaps the most vocal and energetic campaigner on the ground, right? And he leads Armada, I believe it's called, the youth wing of Bersatu. And so Bersatu, despite being kind of a party of established figures, Tun Dr. Mahathir, Muhyiddin Yassin, you know, former Deputy Prime Minister, it really seems to be driven by youthful energy.
I suppose, besides the fact that he is very, seems to be very articulate and smart, that's also a strategy by the party to ensure that, to counterbalance the leadership, really, yeah, so to speak.
You know, the one thing, though, we look around the world for examples. We look at Hong Kong, and I think that young man, I think he's called Marcus. I can't remember his name. Not coming to me, right?
So this is part of that whole umbrella movement.
Yeah, the umbrella movement and some of the young people associated with it. But, you know, we think that young people in politics is a new phenomenon. It isn't. I mean, if you look back in history, Chin Peng, the leader of the Communist Party of Malaya, was a teenager when he joined the movement, when he, in fact, started to take a leadership role.
And wasn't our Prime Minister, Menteri Besar, at a very young age, I think 23 or something like that?
I don't know if he became, I think he entered parliament very young because, you know, taking over his father's seat. But I don't believe he was Mantri Basar in his 20s. But also Josh Wong is the name. Thank you very much to our producers, you know, in the background, very quietly feeding us information. Josh Wong is the young person I was trying to mention. But I think throughout history, young people have always been in politics, especially those, if you think of South Africa, these were secondary school students. If you think of the movement in Singapore, at the middle school revolt was also young teenage. So it's not a new phenomenon, but you know, for some reason, we often forget these historical contexts and we think that millennials are doing something extraordinarily new. Well, you know, okay, we'll be back with a look at a suggestion that we jeer racist politicians. Now, is that fair? Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was The Last Shadow Puppets, an English band, with their song Come Like You. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. It's coming up to 50 minutes past 6 in the morning, or 10 to 7, as some people might say. It's the 22nd of March, 2018. We can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us or tweeting us on BFM Radio. Now, let's turn to the question of the general elections coming up and how we should comport ourselves. What should be our demeanor when faced with a range of voices that appear?
Yeah, so I think the question, you know, Sharad, one of the things is, how do we respond when we hear something that's really racist or against our value systems? So Human Rights Commissioner Gerald Joseph suggests that politicians should be booed or jeered when they say something racist. He says it's time for Malaysians to move away from politicians who bank on race and religion to win.
Oh, that's an interesting statement coming from somebody, I guess, who's in many ways tasked now with upholding a kind of human rights perspective in Malaysian society when it comes to laws and policies and such. So the question is, where does this jeering fit in? Is it a very Malaysian thing to jeer?
I think that everyone jeers across cultures, right?
They do. Okay, so in what context? I mean, I'm trying to think back to a time, Brian, when I heard Malaysians or a group of people jeer, you know, for something they didn't like.
I'm sure in a political rally, and I've heard jeering in political rallies in the last general election.
Oh, did you? I can't really remember that. I imagine in football games, there's quite a bit of jeering that goes on.
Absolutely.
Sometimes for the opponent, sometimes for your own team.
That's part of the whole atmosphere in a football game.
Yeah, and so, you know, we accept that, right, in a football game kind of scenario. In fact, the other day I was at a play. I didn't particularly like it. You know, my aunt who was with me said, you know, she didn't particularly like it. She says, you know, she was recounting a musical that happened in Britain. It was a remake of an old opera, and people didn't like it, and they jeered. They jeered the performers at the end of the performance. She said, "You know, Malaysians are too polite. We don't like something. We just quietly slink away. We don't actually confront our problems."
I think Sharad, in a theatre performance or a play, or you know, if you go to the MPO, nobody's going to jeer the performers.
Yeah, and why is that? Is it because we're too polite, or is it because we think that we don't want to be, we don't have to show our own opinions? Because when you jeer, when you boo somebody, you are demonstrating publicly your personal feelings. Now, you might have very negative feelings about performance, but if you don't say anything and you just move away, nobody's going to know how you feel about it.
But Sharad, it shuts down the conversation between people. So I may think that it's bad. So let's just say a theatre performance. I may think it's bad can you imagine I'm the only one jeering and everyone else actually liked it?
Yeah, well, okay. So shutting down the conversation is an interesting a point that you make. And I'm thinking of situations where when, say, you go to the MPO and there are applause at the end and there's a standing ovation, right? We're demonstrating in a positive sense our feelings. But why aren't we allowed to demonstrate collectively our negative feelings? And shouldn't that also be... Are we supposed to just sit on our hands?
I think in Malaysia and some other countries as well, in polite company, so in an MPO, I think you're not so demonstrative of your emotions.
Well, you are.
On a positive level, you will. But in a football game, I think all your emotions just come out and just flow, and people jeer, people cheer.
Okay, so you're saying it's the context. The context is one, sports allows for a fuller range of emotions. You're saying in an MPO, you know, a philharmonic situation, a concert hall, you're only allowed to demonstrate if it's positive, but you're not allowed to demonstrate your feelings that they're negative.
Have you? I haven't been to an NPO performance where someone has actually just walked out or stuff like that.
You haven't been?
I haven't.
So the question is why and why not? You know, shouldn't we allow for the full range of emotions? And especially when it comes to politics. I mean, if somebody does say something that is racist and you yourself are not racist, why shouldn't you boo?
I think there should be different ways. We should try to shut down the politician one way or the other. How? I'm not particularly sure. But really, basically voting with our feet and everyone sort of moving away because we closing our ears, for example, to demonstrate that we
Fingers in your ears.
Absolutely. Like everyone getting together, putting your hands to your ears.
That sounds like something that kids might do. Okay, shutting down the conversation. I think back of, you know, demonstrations against, say, right, you know, by liberal left activists against, say, right-wing politicians. And I sometimes wonder about that because I understand the feelings about criticizing the speaker. But I think shutting down their right to speak is something that doesn't sit well with me. I think that there's something fundamentally wrong with trying to shut down the conversation.
But especially in this case, so we're talking about the general election and racism and things like that. That sort of behavior, you know, should not be tolerated at all.
What kind of behavior?
I mean, the just racism? Racist sentiment.
But, you know, there are racists in the country and there are people who are going to cheer. I mean, they'll say something. You might call it racist. Other people say, well, it's solidarity for my community, right? Oh, we don't know. Tell us what you think.
We beg to differ.
Yeah. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Taking us up to the next and second bulletin of the morning is Radiohead with Karma Police. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Brian Fernandez. And the morning run continues at just 7:07 in the morning. It's the 22nd of March, 2018. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Or tweeting us at BFM Radio. In fact, we did get some WhatsApp responses following that discussion, Brian, we had just now about jeering or booing racist politicians, a suggestion made by a member of the National Human Rights Commission. Ian says jeering is not part of Asian culture because we tend to give face, whereas Western culture is more vocal. I do think that because that there's some truth in that, but Asian, Western, Asia's a big place. And I think you'll see that in parts of Asia, people are quite vocal as well. Don't you think?
Yeah, I think so too.
Absolutely. Definitely. Okay, yesterday we spoke extensively about statelessness and statelessness, especially stateless children. And we looked at a story of a top scorer in STPM, Roysa Abdullah. Now, her story of being stateless and not being able to continue her education came to the attention of the Higher Education Minister, Dr. Sri Idris Jusso. Now, he was moved by her plight and decided that he would help her out, not just to get a place at university, but also to help her get citizenship. Yesterday, she met with the Minister of Higher Education, and there's a planned meeting with the Home Minister. Now, this all sounds like great news, but the question is it necessary for a person's plight to receive media attention before the government intervenes? We spoke to lawyer Nizam Bashir to get his thoughts on the matter.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's how things seem to work here, particularly when, you know, there's no legislation regulating what needs to be done, what are the rights that these parties have. And, you know, they are dependent essentially on the discretion of the Home Ministry to resolve the problem. And I think that's not healthy. Certainly, I think the best way forward is, you know, we should have this down in terms of a statute. Then maybe it will be much clearer for parties who are, you know, in a similar situation.
Now, the Home Minister under the Federal Constitution has discretionary powers to approve applications for citizenship, and it's done on a case-by-case basis. We asked Nizam, is this a good thing?
Well, I certainly think that, on the one hand, while some amount of discretion is sensible, but nevertheless, it is still sensible to ensure that the discretion is not as untrammeled as it is at the moment. And the best way to ensure that it is not as unlimited as it is now is to ensure that there's appropriate statutory provisions regulating exactly the exercise of his power. In fact, you know, in some other jurisdictions, for example, like in Australia, you know, it's a matter of course, for example, where someone, if they are adopted, by a particular parent, irrespective of whether they are stateless or otherwise, citizenship is conferred on the parent in question. Whereas here in Malaysia, that is not the case. Just because you may have got adoption papers for a child, it doesn't necessarily mean that the child has citizenship or nationality conferred on the child the moment that the adoption goes through. So it's certainly something that we need to look into and remedy, because otherwise you will have cases like this going viral. And, you know, in the child in question's case, it's even worse. She's a good student. She's, by all accounts, bright. And it's very unfortunate that she's not being able to capitalize on all the opportunities that this country has to offer her, merely because she doesn't have the requisite papers.
That was lawyer Nizam Bashir on the case of Roysa Abdullah, and also on the larger situation of childhood statelessness in the country and what seems to be missing in the mix in Malaysia that we have in other countries.
Sharad, one of the things that's come out of our conversation the last 2 days, really, and all the issues that are coming out in the newspapers, is how many gaps, all the gaps there are in our legal framework of how to deal with these people. So this is one of the reasons why the problem has become such a big problem, because there's so many gaps.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the laws.
The gaps are one thing. And it's also just, I think, the attitude. Yesterday when we had a panel discussion with a representative of UNICEF as well as Dr. Hatini from Yayasan Chowkit. I mean, one of the things that we talked about was this idea that citizenship is not a right, but a privilege, and is a gift almost from government. And so, you know, when I read these stories, and while I'm heartened that ministers are moved by the plight of individuals, it's that, again, that individual is grateful to the minister. The minister seems to be bestowing a gift. You know, it's something we call a petitionary culture. That's not about creating petitions, meaning you always have to appeal to a higher authority and you have to thank them and be grateful. That petitionary culture is really very feudal. It's not a modern form of political culture.
I agree with you totally, Sharad. So one of the things I feel that could be done, and I'm just looking at it in terms of what Nizam said earlier about Australia. I'm surprised that if you adopt a child, the child is still not Malaysian, despite the fact that both parents are Malaysians.
Yeah. In fact, you look at a lot of the scenarios that lead children to be stateless include being born out of wedlock. So, I mean, the child is already a victim.
Yeah, why stigmatize the child further?
And victimize them by depriving them of a legal status, right? So, again, what I think we ought to see from politicians on both sides of the divide when confronting these issues is not the personal, I will help you out, I'll pull a few strings with you, I know the other minister, I'm going to take you for a meeting. It's like, this is the appropriate policy response. We need a policy response. We don't just need things pitched at the individual.
And Sharad, that should be the policy response from where both sides of the divide get together and solve it.
Absolutely, a bipartisan response to this. We'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.